G'day, team. Hope you are terrific. Welcome to another installment of The U Project. Tiffany Ann Cook, hi.
Good afternoon, Craig Anthony Harper.
You all right?
Yep, I'm good.
What have you been up to today? Well, let me just give everyone an update. It's 5:04 in the thriving metropolis of Melbourne, and I just inhaled a bit of food because I've got a mentoring group till 10 tonight, so I had a little snackaroonie. Otherwise, I would have cognitive failure at about 8:15 tonight, I think.
Which would not be good for an 8 o'clock workshop. What did you have for dinner?
Well, I didn't have dinner. I had a snack. I have these little meat burgers that I make, which are just minced beef and vegetables. So a bit of zucchini, bit of carrot, bit of onion. So no starchy carbs, about 200 grams. And I just eat one of those by itself. So it's kind of like it's not really a snack, but it's not really a meal. But like, you know, this is, let's keep talking about this, but let's say hello to Ingrid. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi, Craig. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thanks for joining us for the 900th time. Let's just finish this conversation because I think it's interesting, and jump in if you want. Maybe either of you have got a thought or an opinion, but you know how we're constantly trying to figure out, all of us are trying to figure out how our body works optimally. And I've banged on about, you know, my relationship with food and how I keep manipulating things. And when I've got to do night workshops, like my mind works best, I reckon, typically, just in general terms, I reckon between 6 a.m. and about 4, right, p.m. Now, that doesn't mean I can't work from 8 till 10, but what it means is I need to kind of manage myself through the day in terms of output, energy expenditure, food, even having a bit of rest so that, and even maybe go, don't tell anyone, going and getting a coffee at 7:45, maybe not, who knows, right? But if I eat something that's more like a meal with some, you know, like say some rice and chicken and like a proper meal, I'm gone. So that's my thing. So the kind of the meat patty and the veggies take the edge off. But like, you know, when you eat something like that, you could eat three more.
Sorry. Said granddaughter has arrived home. That's why they're barking. Sorry.
I thought that was you barking. I thought you were just endorsing my comments.
I bark slightly differently.
Let's hear. Hey, what about you, Tiff? Do you have a set kind of operating system with your food? Like, are you quite regimented or more freestyle?
I like to be a little bit regimented. When I do intermittent fasting, I'm at my best. So when I train in the mornings, don't eat until mid-morning or lunchtime, the rest of my day and my energy works well and my behaviour around food works well. When I don't, when I get up and I eat, then especially when there's no structure like right now in lockdown, it's just a whole day of eating instead of training and eating instead of training. And, you know, I'll eat first and then I'll train later. And then it's time to train and I pretend I'm hungry again. And it's just turmoil.
Well, don't do that. Just do intermittent fasting if that's what works.
I know, but, you know.
You're a grown up now. What about you, Doc? Are you quite methodical or are you? I think you're probably more methodical than freestyle.
Yeah, yes and no. The first half of the day, I'm very methodical. Because I start work early, I don't have breakfast before I go to work, but I'll have every day at about 11, I'll have some berries, as in blueberries and strawberries, with some Greek yogurt. I'll have that every day. And then I eat again at the end of the day. That's the regular bit. The irregular bit is I always struggle with being a bit of a grazer into the late evening. And I try to not do that. That's an ongoing project.
If both of you could have one get out of jail card food, right? One like crap food that tastes amazing, but it's terrible for you, but it could magically have no calories and no negative side effects. So you could pick one. You know, when you're playing cards, sometimes you can use a joker and it can be any card you want. Because it's a bit magic.
Yeah.
Like if you could have the same, like you could have a joker meal where it could be anything, but there's no calories and there's no negative consequence, what would it be or what might be on the short list?
Oh, mine's easy. Mine's really easy. It's they would be peanut butter balls.
Oh.
From Boost.
Really? Well, that's not even that bad.
But there's got a lot of sugar in them. And if I just ate as many as I wanted, I'd eat six in a day. So I try to ration myself.
Mm. I like too many things. You know what I love? Like fried rice, literally from like a Chinese joint with heaps of chicken, salty as fuck, like bit of MSG, bit of oil, onion. Oh, yeah. Or awesome, awesome hamburger or my mum's lasagna.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and the list goes on, and don't even open the cheesecake door because then we're never coming back.
I was just about to say you're clearly not a sweet tooth.
What about you, Tiff?
Mine's dark lint with sea salt.
Oh.
What, is that even bad?
Yeah.
Well, it is because when I get a block or two blocks, I've got that abnormal high heart rate going on again.
Really?
Yeah.
What is your heart rate right now?
Well, when it stops beeping, I'll be able to tell you. It'll be something it's over 100 beats a minute because that's why it's beeping at me. I have just trained, though. I literally just stopped training 10 minutes ago.
Your heart rate should be well under 100 by now.
Well, it's probably because I thought of the dark lint with sea salt.
Have you got one of those? What do you call those watches, Doc?
I got two.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Now, everyone, Ingrid just held up both wrists and there's two, there's one, is it a Garmin?
One is a Garmin and the other one's an Apple. And I know people keep on asking me, why do I have two? They measure different things. A lot of the things they measure are the same, but there are some differences. So my Garmin will give me my VO2 max, which my Apple Watch will not give me. With the Apple, I'd like to sort of, as they say, if anybody knows the Apple rings, I like to close all my rings and cut my steps every day.
Mm.
So there's something to be gained out of both of those.
Hmm.
Surely there's one product that does both.
The Apple does most of them, but it won't give me a VO2 max. And to get a VO2 max, you've really got to wear it all the time that you're exercising.
Can somebody who knows better than us three, who's somebody who's an expert, which none of us are, including the exercise scientist, can somebody hit us up and tell the good doc, is there one that does VO2 max and all the other stuff?
I reckon, have you looked at the Whoop band?
I've heard about Whoop, but
Pretty great, okay. Yeah. Give that a crack. If there's a cardiologist listening, Harps, I wouldn't mind them letting me know whether or not this abnormally high heart rate detection I keep getting is an issue because
it's
happened a few times.
You might have a cardiac issue. So try and hold on till about 6 o'clock, will you, if you're going to have any kind of infarction. And I've had enough people having bloody heart attack. Well, you know, I've had enough people dying in front of me, cardiac arrest. I've had enough. I don't need another one. So you'll be fine. Maybe you're, I don't know what's going on with you. Anyway, Doc, thanks for joining us. How's life over in the thriving metropolis?
Yeah, we're doing well, Greg. We're luckier than most. So most of us are leading a relatively...
Wow. That's not loud at all. Where the fuck is that phone from? 1956?
No.
Hello?
No. It's the Apple whatever, 12, the iPhone 12. No, it's not from
that's
sorry, you were saying?
Oh, I'm so rude. That's an old person ring, if ever I've heard an old person ring.
All right, I'll customise it.
That's hilarious. All right, back to Adelaide. Everyone's like, what the fuck is this? Is this an episode? Are they about to do the episode in a minute? Is this it? Has it started?
We have no active, if you're talking COVID, as everybody does, we have no active new cases. We've got a couple in Medi hotels that have come from overseas, but we have none in the community. So we're pretty lucky. There are some limitations. So restaurants and places like that are at probably half capacity now. But if I think about you folk, then we have nothing to complain about. I went to get a coffee this morning and I couldn't get a table in a place where normally I can. And I thought, damn, only half the amount of tables. And then I quickly did an about turn and thought, shut up, Ingrid, be grateful.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are layers and levels, aren't there? There's a scale, and at one end of the scale is probably Adelaide at the moment, and the other end of the scale is Afghanistan. So we're all doing okay. Yeah, and, you know, I'm thinking about all of those people and anyone listening who's got anyone over there, any loved ones or family. Wow, you know, thoughts and love go out to you. So in the middle of all of that, you're still working as normal. I know you were, have you gone back to, of course, for those who don't know Dr. Ingrid, shame on you. She's a psychiatrist working at Royal Adelaide Hospital, been on a bunch and one of our favourite humans. And we love talking to you because we, of course, you understand the head stuff and the mind stuff and the human behavior stuff, but also because you yourself are interesting in the way that you live and the way that you optimize your health and your performance and your fitness and your mindset and your potential. At, are you 73 at the minute? Is that 74?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't say that for any reason other than you don't look or feel or sound or seem or live your age. You know, like, yeah, we've spent a bit of time together and I never ever think, and I'm not trying to make you feel good, but I never feel like I'm hanging out with someone who's whatever you are, 17 years older than me. It's like you seem like someone who's a fit, healthy 50-something. Definitely, you know, so so how's work? What are you up to? What's the plan? Are you going to retire at any stage? What's that about?
That dirty word. I'm still working. I'm working 4 days a week in the emergency department, probably doing a little bit less after hours work. And, the grand plan is to reduce that. I don't think I'm quite ready to stop it altogether. Having said that, I think I want to do something else as well, something else, something different, completely different.
Wow.
So retirement, we talk about it all the time, and it was interesting. I just listened this morning to you and PT talking about it, and I just think it's a redundant word these days. It used to be a time, like in my father's day, when you reached a certain age and you retired and that was it. But I think now people slide more and more from paid employment to possibly less paid employment to unpaid other stuff, interests and so on. And, of course, there are problems with people who stop altogether, which we've discussed before. But, retirement is the word. I actually feel healthier and fitter now than I did when I was 50. So it's my age is just a number. Occasionally the bones creak and things like that, but, you know, that's nothing.
I always think if somebody met you, for example, or me or whoever, but if somebody met you and you were having the same conversation with them and you had the same fitness and you had the same job and you drove the same car, everything was the same, but you were 45, would anybody be asking you about retirement, right?
No.
Like, it's not like, oh, she's forgetting names and she's, you know, she's hit the wall and she's 40 kilos overweight and she can't get out of a chair and you know, the dementia's kicking in. And like, there's, other than the fact that you are chronologically 74 and people have a story around when is appropriate to retire or to think about retirement or to semi-retire, you know, I think it's definitely not a bad thing, but I think the idea of retirement, like the story that we have in our culture about, you know, this pot of gold at the end of this working life, you know, metaphoric gold, is, you know, I think the idea and the reality for many people are vastly different.
Yeah, without a doubt. And over the years, I've spoken to so many people who have been counting the days, and I still see people who say, you know, 1,523 days to retirement kind of thing, and their life will hold for that whole period.
Yeah.
And it's often, unless they've set things in place, it's often, well, usually not what they expect it to be. And then when I was in private practice, I used to see that whole process of them waiting, you know, hanging out for that day, And yeah, a bit of a honeymoon period, but then not all that long after that. Oh my God, what have I done? You know, I don't get out of bed in the morning and I've nothing to do and I don't feel meaningful. But hopefully these days people are doing less and less of that. I think in this age of, you know, part-time employment and changing jobs and things like that, it's more possible.
What are the things that, I mean, I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to say, but let's just have this conversation anyway momentarily, because we have people who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s and 20s listening to this. What's your advice for people who are thinking about retiring? When we're not saying don't retire, by the way, and we're not saying retiring's good or retiring's bad. We're saying maybe how you do it is the question, not whether you do it or when you do it, but how you do it when that happens. What are some of the things that people could keep or should keep in mind to make sure or to hopefully increase the chances of that process being a positive rather than a negative and something that improves their life rather than makes it worse?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to use the analogy of what we call cross titration of drugs. So when you're gradually reducing the dose of one and then gradually at the same time increasing the dose of the other one. I think people, if they're not already looking at lifestyle issues, then they should do that. They should have another interest that they either start developing before they stop working, not after. Involvement with something, with the community, with anything at all is another thing. And I guess it varies depending on whether people are single or married. Certainly if someone's single at the time of retirement, that becomes even more important because involvement, relationships, friendships are super, super important.
Yeah.
And then if they have not kept themselves physically active, then I think that's probably the most important thing to look at improving your aerobic capacity, improving your muscle strength with strength training, weights. That's really important. And it's never ever too late to start that. People will often say to me, oh, and I should have done that 20 years ago. Yeah, probably. But what's the option now? Just never do it and then end up with, you know, osteoporosis and hip fractures and falling over and that kind of stuff. So I think one needs to plan. And clearly, aside from financial planning, which everybody knows about, yeah. I think we need to plan lifestyle issues. And new learning. I think new learning is so important in terms of brain plasticity. I mean, might sound crazy, but I've just signed up for a carpentry course.
Of course, you have.
Well, I've always wanted to, you know, I felt bad about things, just ordinary little things around the house that I wanted to fix. And I've had to ask my son to come in and help me with it. Mm. I don't want to be a carpenter. I don't want to be employed as a carpenter. Mm. I don't even want to have the full blown skills of a carpenter. I just want to be able to do stuff.
Mm. That's hilarious, but it's great. Oh, I love it. And I think one of the problems is sometimes people go into retirement with an idea of what retirement will look like, but no actual plan about what they will do. And not that it needs to be a daily grind of ticking boxes and, you know, fulfilling certain criteria, but I'm with you. Like, I don't want to just go, right, I'm retired. Now I'm just going to start to decline. Mm. I go, well, yeah, well, can I learn new things? Not only can I learn, but could I actually at 70 improve my cognitive function, my memory, my creativity? Could I write a book? Could I learn a language? Could I do a carpentry course and build a table? Could I do an online program? Could I learn, you know, like it, there are so many, not because we have to be a perpetual student, but rather so that we actually keep our brain working and we keep our mind working and we keep our body working rather than going, I'm just going to switch off now and slide towards the finish line and stumble across in 7 years. Like, what if you retired and then when you retired, your physical, mental and emotional health got better?
Yep. And I absolutely think that's possible. I see no reason why, you know, disease aside, see no reason why that shouldn't happen. And it just requires little things, little adaptations as we go along. And, you know, I've heard recently, and I'm sure this is true, that one of the predictors of one of many predictors of living longer is how fast you can, well, lots, but how fast you can walk.
Yeah.
So now I know I do a lot of walking. I probably walk about 30 Ks a week. So now when I walk, I put a particular effort into walking faster and picking up my feet properly. I mean, have you seen old people shuffle along? And that's half the reason that they fall. They don't lift their feet up properly. So it just takes, and it's interesting because if you focus on that as you're walking for 10 minutes, and then you distract yourself with a Craig Harper podcast, you find you keep on picking up your feet. So it's just focusing on those certain things. And that's also, it might sound funny, that's also new learning. That's focusing on something physical, putting all your attention on that, and then making that part of your brain circuitry so that you don't end up shuffling.
Mm. You've been listening to Andrew Huberman again, haven't you?
Oh, I love Andrew Huberman. I do.
Yeah, he's a ripper. He's a ripper. Yeah. So if you, I've mentioned this 20 times, but for those who have missed it, he has a podcast, which is great. He also has, if you want just really good, succinct, bite-sized installments of scientific insight and wisdom that you can understand, for the most part, it gets a bit deep, but for the most part, just go to Huberman, H-U-B-E-R, Man Lab, L-A-B, on Instagram. He actually put up a thing, Tiff, you'll be interested in this. He put up a thing today. I did not know this. I had no clue about this. Talking about creatine and saying that not only does it help or it can help athletic performance and, you know, build muscle, develop power, you know, it's kind of like a, it's not, but you could call it a, it, like a very mild steroid, but it's actually quite, there's some good science around it, but forget the physical. What he was saying is there's been some rock solid studies done recently to say that it can and does for many people reduce anxiety and depression, which is, I'm like, I had no idea. And it wasn't actually, in inverted commas, built for that, but they're finding people that, and by the way, this is not a prescription or recommendation to anyone. This is just literally me thinking out loud because I heard it today and I went, fuckity fuck, I didn't know that. So, I think I might get some creatine because any cognitive edge I can get, I'm taking it.
Is it just because people walk past the mirror and see their big guns because their guns are growing?
Yeah, imagine if your biceps and your IQ are growing like at the same time, at the same rate.
I listened to Andrew on that as well. And what I loved about his talk, and this is the way we're going now, really, in terms of depression, is just not looking at depression as a psychiatric illness. In fact, not looking at anything in that very isolated way, but looking at any disease process as a total body issue. So it's not just, depression is not just about getting the right medication. It's about your gut microbiome. It's about a whole ton of things. And you know, this is where we're moving away a little bit from what, you know, we were taught when I was at medical school, but that's, you know, that's 100 years ago. But there are a lot of people that still practice under that sort of philosophy of, you know, yeah, you've got depressed or you're psychotic or whatever, let's look at the medication. And absolutely, that's often necessary, but it's never the only solution.
Yeah.
And I used to see sometimes people whose only solution needed to be a lot of lifestyle changes. So I think you can have the lifestyle changes without the medication necessarily. But, and I always say to people, you can never have the medication without the lifestyle changes. That just will get you precisely nowhere.
Well, and depression is interesting. And I'm no psychiatrist, but like everything from medication to meditation to socialization to lifestyle to exercise to nutrition to laughter. We recently had a professor, she's of neuroscience. Do you remember her name, Tiff? She was
Sophie
only
Scott.
Sophie Scott. She was a ripper. She was talking about the relationship, like what happens to your immune system and you know, what's happening on a cellular level when you're laughing. And, you know, there are just so, as you said, there are just so many components that, and there are so many things that we can do that might only be a 1% or 2% impact, but when you do lots of things well, now you're putting in yourself in the best place of being mentally, emotionally, and physically well.
I heard a little comment today, or it was in one of my various audiobooks, that said, and I think it was Louis Pasteur from way back, 100 years ago or whatever, who, when he was dying, he reviewed his whole view of things, and he said, it's not all about the pathogen, it's about the territory. Now, the pathogen is anything that makes us sick. It could be depression, it could be cancer, it could be arthritis, it could be anything. And the territory is us. So we can change the territory, and the territory can affect the progress of the pathogen. Pathogen you can't do much about, but the territory, where it lands, where that disease lands, as in our bodies, we can change that territory enormously.
Yeah.
And that was from a man, it's a long time ago that he was around, and he was from the man who sort of worked up bacteria and viruses and antibiotics and stuff like that. So I think that's very true. We, there's a lot that we can do.
And I think we're understanding more and more. We're coming to understand that there are so many things that, I read something the other day that said men that are married, the benefits to being married, which doesn't bode well for me, does it? That's okay.
I don't know so much married as involved with other people.
But that socialization. I was talking to someone yesterday. In fact, I walked to the supermarket, which is the social highlight of my week, with my two bags because I'm an excitement machine, and I bumped into the wife of one of my ex-trainers, Fleur. Shout out to Fleur. And she was telling me that one of her kids caught up, not for a play date because they can't, but just with one of their friends walking. And she said, just walking with her friend for an hour, she said, it was like the best thing that's happened to her in 3 months. And she said, my child came home a different person. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, it is so, like, the power of human connection and laughter and that kind of emotional stuff that goes on, and especially little kids who've got best friend ever, you're like my best friend ever in the whole world, and all that kind of gorgeous stuff that goes on. And we're probably not that cognizant of it day to day, where we're trying to shove carrots and broccoli into them, and maybe what they need is a Mars bar and a walk around the park with their mate.
Or they could walk around the park with a carrot.
Don't be ridiculous. It's a stupid idea. All right. Now, Tiff and I were talking off the back of Professor Erin Cotter-Smith, who spoke about vicarious trauma. And I was talking about feeling a bit flat the other day, which I never do. Well, I shouldn't say I never do, but I rarely do. I reckon maybe one day a year I feel a bit flat. And I generally don't know why. And I was talking about this the other day on the show, and it's so. Where are we now? Wednesday, and was it this weekend or last weekend that I felt a bit flat? I think it was this weekend. Was it, Tiff? I don't know. Doesn't matter. Anyway, I don't feel flat anymore. But it was about a day and a half. I felt shit. And I'm like, I don't. It even surprises me. I don't mean to sound like a weirdo, but I really don't. I'm not saying every day I bounce out of bed and I'm in love with life, but I rarely feel flat or emotionally, down. I don't really feel it. Some days I'm a little bit more anxious or sidetracked because I've got 58 things to get done that day, but it's not stress in a horrible way. And I figured out that, and I'm not sure, but maybe because I'm having an increasing number of traumatic. They're not traumatic conversations, but they're conversations with traumatized people. So whereas I used to have X, which is just my normal life, now I probably have 3X. And so the numbers increased and the stress has increased and the trauma and the emotional stuff and the conversations and the intensity. And sometimes, you know, you just like, I don't even know where to go now. Like, I understand what you're saying and I get it, but there's actually no solution to this. Like there's no quick or obvious solution to this. And sometimes I feel a bit, not that they expect me to fix it, but a bit helpless, you know? And, but generally just being there listening and, you know, sharing a bit of love and a few thoughts and ideas is valuable. But yeah, and I came away and I'm like, I don't know about that. And I feel a bit, and Tiff said it's vicarious trauma. And I went, no. And then I went, oh, maybe, because I do talk to a lot of people. You do more, and we're going to talk about it and your life. But just explain what vicarious trauma is, Ingrid.
Well, it's basically trauma, to put it in really simple terms. That's almost transferred from the original individual to whom the trauma, with whom the trauma has occurred. And in the process of listening to all of that and absorbing all of those details, we identify so closely with people that we are affected by that and can be affected for not just while they're speaking to us, but for quite some time afterwards, that, you know, you can replay these things that have happened to people, often with that sense of helplessness that you describe. And I think people who talk to us don't always expect us to fix it. Mm. And I think people often don't realize how much we take on board just because we're human.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I guess we're all in that because we want to be. That's why I have been doing what I've done, because I like that sort of work. But it doesn't make me less human, and it doesn't make me less inclined to over, let's say, you know, a whole day absorb a lot of that and have to deal with it afterwards. And I guess, you know, for many people probably you'd be the same. It's something that you do on your own. You don't go home and share it with 20 people. A lot of the things are things that can't be, well, certainly from my professional point of view, can't be shared anyway. Mm. So you go home and you absorb that. And then in your case, you have 10 other phone calls. And in my case, as the years have gone by, I get home and, you know, you open the front door and the kids want to know what's for dinner, et cetera, et cetera. Not anymore, because they've got their own homes. But it's almost as if you're dealing with that on your own. So that original person might feel a little bit better. Hopefully they do, because of your help. Mm. But then we're dealing with that in a different way as well. And I think people underestimate that. And lots of people are exposed to that sort of trauma. And it's not just the traditionally acknowledged fields of, you know, frontline workers and so on. I think it's wider than that. I think it can occur within families as well. And certainly with any sort of caregiver.
I would think there's a lot of vicarious trauma going on at the minute or being experienced at the moment. I used to use this term, or I've used this term a bit, but originally it came from my work in the gym, on the gym floor, training lots of humans, and my staff, my team, who used to also do lots and lots of back-to-back appointments with people. And of course, it's not as, I guess, challenging on many levels as, you know, being a psychiatrist working with very complicated issues and people who are in a lot of suffering. But at the same time, I did for years, I would do 12 hours a day, 5 days a week at least, and probably 8 hours on a Saturday. But I would do on a typical day, probably 12 hours of training people. I'd get in there at 5:30. I'd start at 5:30. I'd maybe have an hour or two off through the day, and I'd train people till 8 or 9, depends on schedule and stuff. But I used to say to my team, figure out how many sessions you can do a day and be present.
Yep.
And not let it kill you. And deliver the same level of service and effort and energy and attention and value every time. Mm-hmm. And if I'm being honest, of course, I didn't do that every time. I think I had a pretty high threshold. But if I'm being self-aware and real, definitely the quality of what I did from probably, you know, 6 and 7 in the morning to 9 at night, probably there was a drop off. Mm-hmm. But So my long-winded question is, how do you be, because you're dealing with really complicated stuff, how do you stay present and how do you stay up for however many sessions or appointments, I should say, that you do per day and be just as present and just as attentive and just as, for want of a better word, good at your job, you know, 8-9 hours after you started?
Yeah. I mean, it's a process of ongoing sort of examination of how you are at the end of each day or each week, for example. I certainly found at some stage, I was in private practice for 20 years, and certainly halfway through that, I reached a point where I thought, no, I don't want to do this anymore. Because I think what happens with lots of people is that when you start to be overwhelmed with too much work or too much emotional stuff, most of us will let go of our own personal things. We'll exercise less, we'll go to the movies less, we'll read less, but our professional job is maintained to the end. But obviously, if you get to the end and then you're looking at a point where your professional work is not what it should be, that's clearly time. Well, that's actually too late, but if not before, it's certainly time to say, well, I need to reevaluate that and see how many hours I can work and give that optimal function and still walk away at the end of the day without being totally hammered. And that's, you know, that's trial and error. It also depends a lot on what else is going on in your life. So if everything else is peachy, well, you can probably do that in terms of, you know, seeing more people. But if it's not, you know, we all go home to our other lives. And of course, if there's anything stressful in that, anything, if we had kids or money or relationships or anything, then that will impact on our capacity to be fully present with people away from home or in the work situation.
You're right. I think that threshold will vary. You know, it's like some days I'm great for 12 hours and some days I'm dog shit after five. So, and it's knowing that that's going to happen and being okay with that. And, you know, now and then, depending on how dog shit you are, you might have to rebook some people or change your schedule for the day. So now you sent me a message yesterday and I've said to you, you've got a standing invitation whenever you've got anything you want to talk about, because we love talking to you and we're cranking out 7 a week. So when somebody like you has got something that you want to share, all you got to do is go, let's have a chat about this or that. So you sent me a message. So I'm going to read out that. And if you're mad at me, we can take it out. But I'm only reading out the relevant bits. So you wrote, yes, listening to yesterday's podcast, I thought you should do one on vicarious trauma. I'd be happy to talk about a lifetime, 40 years or so, of working with either the dead or the mentally unwell while trying to maintain my own sanity with varying success. Well, that's true though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, just tell people. So just I'm going to give the quick chronology and you fix what I fuck up. So went into the monastery at 16 to become a nun, came out at 21, studied medicine, became a doctor, was a doctor for a while, then became a medical, what do you call it? Coroner, medical examiner, what do you call it?
Forensic pathologist.
Forensic pathologist doing autopsies. And then psychiatry and so on. But so you were living, when you were a forensic pathologist, in other words, cutting up dead people and trying to find the reason that they died, you're in Joburg?
Yeah.
Wow. What years, give or take, were you a forensic pathologist in Joburg?
We've been from about 76, 77.
Wow.
For about 8 or 9 years.
Wow. And how many?
That was a little bit with helping people who were dying. So doing a bit of work in palliative care.
Right.
On a voluntary basis. I just did that because I was interested. But yeah, what? My job was in.
So you were a doctor and you were doing autopsies through the day and you were volunteering in palliative care around that.
Yep.
Well, well done. Why were you doing that?
I've always had an interest in, I mean, I went from talking to nobody professionally. You can't exactly have conversations with your patients when you're doing forensic pathology, but I liked talking to people, believe it or not. So I worked my way backwards. I always laugh about this. I worked my way backwards and I started working with the dead, which was fascinating in its own right. And in, we can talk about that a bit if you want to, in South Africa at the time, it was quite something. And then I just had this interest in palliative care. And so I and a couple of other people, there actually wasn't a hospice association in Johannesburg at the time. So about four or five of us actually started the first hospice association in Joburg. And we built it up from nothing and just doing sort of home visits to actually having having premises, which was lovely. And then in the process of talking to people, particularly talking to people who are dying, where the focus is not on what medication can I take, what's going to make my cancer, often cancer, not always, better, because that had passed. We were looking at people who's had exhausted all treatment options. And I just loved the openness of talking to people where it's all out on the table and the involvement of the families as well. And that's where often such simple things became so important, not the medical things, just the human things. And, you know, it's probably four decades ago now, but I can still remember visiting a man in his home. He was in the dying process and I was chatting to him in his bedroom and he had big sliding doors that opened up from his bedroom onto a beautiful big lawn, a lovely garden. And we were talking about what he still needed to do and what concerned him. And he said to me, "I'm just really worried because my wife doesn't know how to operate the lawnmower." Yeah. And so I said, "Well, come on, let's go." I forget what her name was. "Let's go out and get the small lawnmower going." And so we went out, we opened the doors and brought out the lawnmower. And between the two of us, I was not exactly an expert, but we chugged along and pulled the cord, et cetera. We got it working. And in the end, she mowed the lawn herself. And that was, I don't know why that's where stuck in my mind, but that was really important for that man. And you've got to be where people are when they're dying. Your agenda doesn't matter. It's what they need and what they need to talk about at the time. So I think it's a real privilege to be part of people's lives at that time, at the end of their lives, and to be involved with their families. And I would remain involved for a little while afterwards as well, with helping the family. So, and I think that led me to my next step. Well, I like talking to people. I like looking at the whole picture as opposed to being a cardiologist looking at the heart or an orthopedic surgeon looking at your fractured hip. I like to look at the person in a total global way. And I think that's pushed me into psychiatry from there. So, yeah.
And so what, I mean, I'm sure there's not one conversation, but what are the conversations that people want to have in the last few days or the last week or two of their life? Is it deep and meaningful? Is it funny? Is it painful? Is it joyful?
It can be all of those things. I mean, if people are helped to approach their last days in a relatively pain-free way, then that opens the doors to them looking at other issues. I think it's difficult to be funny or make, you know, specific plans when you're overwhelmed with pain. So that's always the primary goal, to make people comfortable. And we talk about it being comfort care as opposed to any kind of, curative process. So it's comfort care. That's the main thing. And it varies. I had a very dear friend that I used to run with who died only about 18 months ago here in Adelaide, got a very aggressive cancer and died within a few months. And I was sitting with her at the hospital and she was joking about things. It was as if nothing had happened.
Yeah.
And we were talking about various trips that we had had, and she was a bit of a rebel. So we'd been on various yoga retreats in Bali and Vanuatu, and she'd disappear into the night on the back of some bloke's motorbike and not never know where she was. So we joked about those times. And that was on a Thursday, and she died on the Sunday.
Wow.
So it's so variable, but often it is making arrangements, making sure that your loved ones will be cared for and that everything has been sorted.
And what made you want to, let's be honest, cut open dead people? firstly, how many autopsies? I think I know the answer, but can I guess? I feel like you told me a year or two ago. Was it 7,000 autopsies?
About 7,000. Now, you need to remember, because forensic pathologists will say, what? This was in South Africa, where the crime rate is high. I was not the only forensic pathologist. There were obviously two or three of us on any one day, and we do between 5 and 10 a day. And just to give some comparison to that, in the early 90s, when things were going badly in South Africa and I had young children, and I first decided to come and live in Australia, I actually got a job then as a forensic pathologist in Sydney, in Glebe. And they said to me, well, you know, that you'll do a couple of postmortems a week. And what has been your experience? So, you know, I told them, and I think they were just gobsmacked by the sheer number. But if you look at a society where often the first recourse is to violence in a very big population, and, in, you know, you don't just add murders into that, you add clearly motor vehicle accidents. And in South Africa, people drive, you know, crazily, lots of motor vehicle accidents, lots of deaths. And anything unexpected or unexplained. So I did a huge number of those postmortems and then the appropriate court attendance as well, because a lot of them were, in fact, murders. And so I would need to go to court for that. And what drove a lot of doctors away from doing pathology was not liking the court process, but I actually quite enjoyed it.
Wow.
But yeah, that had its end date as well. And I don't think I would have done that for the rest of my professional life. But I did enjoy it while I was doing it. It gave me a lot of experience.
And did you find that in the moment, as in that period of time when you were doing, by the way, there would have been no one in Australia that had done 7,000 autopsies. You would have been like 6,000 in front of anyone, wouldn't you?
Well, several. But, I mean, we looked, you know, we had a situation, particularly during the race riots in South Africa in the late 70s, and I was working in the mortuary at Soweto, which is just adjacent to the big township there. And nobody actually knew how many deaths there were. We had a huge sort of a receiving area, and there was a very big steel door on either side of that, and the trucks would come in with bodies, and then the outside door was sealed off before the inside door was open. So nobody actually knew the number of deaths, and there were a lot of things that were not said at that time, because there was violence from the side of the police, and so it was there was a lot that was not actually discussed in South Africa, or you could not say. And that just takes me a change of topic, but the same sort of an issue in South Africa. When I was training as a psychiatric registrar, that was the time when we had a lot of what they call political prisoners. So the crime of these people who were detained was to belong to the wrong political party. Predominantly at that time, the ANC, the African National Congress. And so these people would be locked away for quite long periods and almost inevitably develop some kind of a psychiatric problem. And for a long time, we as doctors were not allowed to see them. And we eventually negotiated to be able to see them, but we were driven, as were the political prisoners, down into the laundry area of the hospital where we saw them secretly.
Really?
And initially, the people who were guarding them said, well, you can see them, but we're standing in, which, of course, defeats the whole purpose of the discussion. Eventually, we persuaded them to at least stand outside the door. But this was a whole lot of stuff that we couldn't discuss at the time at all. There was no way I was ever going to be able to even go home and say what I had been doing during the day. So South Africa was a very difficult place to live in and became progressively more so until I eventually decided to leave. I mean, commonplace, my home was divided up into three sections with security doors in between all three sections. Wow. So that if somebody broke in, you could go to another section of the house and they couldn't readily get you. So people can't actually conceive of that. And when I came here in 91, and I was in Tasmania for the first 4 years, I remember walking up and down the beach and saying, oh, my God, I can walk on this beach.
Yeah.
My kids, who were quite young at that stage, the same thing. You know, we don't have to look over our shoulders. We can actually walk along the beach and it's safe. And to this very day, and it's 30 years, this end of this year, it'll be 30 years that I've been here. To this day, I never fail to be grateful for living in this country. You know, I go walking, I go running, I feel safe. My kids can do whatever they want to do. And sure, there's crime everywhere. But when you've lived in a country where it's so endemic that you're afraid to walk in the street, and where you're exposed to it, if you work in the system, you're exposed to it all the time.
Mm.
And it's all you know at the time. It was only after I left the country and then went back to visit when my parents were still alive. And then went back to visit, and it covers you like a blanket.
Yeah.
It's like an oppressive blanket, and there's a fear that permeates everybody. And then I'd get onto the plane to come back to Australia, and it would be, phew, thank goodness, you know, I'm leaving.
Mm.
And when you grow up in a country like that, you don't know anything else, really.
Mm. Yeah, I went to Joburg in 1999, and it was like stepping on to another planet. I was shocked, and wow. It was the biggest culture shock. And I've been to a few places, and I was doing some volunteer work with an organization working with kids who are HIV positive.
Yeah.
And I remember, I might've told this once, if you've heard it, I apologize, folks. But so, you know, there were a lot of, you know, pregnancies that weren't intended. And there are a lot of young mums giving birth to babies that they didn't want. And I went to this place called Door of Hope. And it was basically there was a wall out the front. So it was like a refuge of sorts, I guess. There's a wall out the front that was, I would say, 10 feet high. And on top of that, a razor wire, like rolled up razor wire. So that was probably 12 feet altogether.
Yep.
And then in the middle of this big wall that kind of surrounded this property was a silver door. I can remember it was a cream fence and a silver door. And think of the size of, say, the top of a washing machine. The door was about that big. And anyway, we went into this place. We were, the charity that I was working with was trying to figure out where they were going to spend their money. And it was kind of a bit of a recce, but we're also working there. We're also, you know, feeding kids and doing practical stuff as well as a bit of research. But I went inside. I said, what's that thing in the wall? And the lady said, come out and I'll show you. And there's another door on the inside. And then she opens it up and it's like a little cradle with cushions and pillows that the mums could take these brand new, literally 10-minute old babies and put them through this wall on this, through this door, and an alarm would go inside and literally the staff would go out and there'd be a brand new baby in there and they'd just bring it in.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't even want to say what they were doing with the babies, but you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was so upset. I'm like, how does this go on in the world? How do I not know this?
Mm-hmm.
Why does the world, you know, and that, and much worse, of course, in lots of places. But mm-hmm. Yeah, it was anyway, it's not about me, but that was a confronting and that was a life-changing experience for me, because I realized how much of a bubble I lived in over here on bloody you know, Planet Craig. How did you, get traumatized? Were you aware of any trauma when you were doing autopsies on 7,000 people?
Oh, you do, because you see people coming in having been, you know, without going into great details, severely assaulted and you know, all of those sorts of things, where the knife is a really easy thing for people to pick up, and it happens commonly. And then one of the other things that we saw at that time, hopefully it's a bit less now, quite a lot, was the process of what they called necklacing. And necklacing was if somebody was going to be killed, they would put their hands at their sides, put a motor vehicle tire over the top of their head, sink down to their middle area, hands pinned in, and set it alight. And I had one very scary experience, because at the time I was married to a man who was an actor, also a TV presenter and journalist. And in the middle of the race riots, he and another reporter went in to Soweto, where normally at that time you would not go, drove into Soweto, stupidly asked directions to be headed towards a demonstration that was occurring then in the middle of Soweto, and drove straight into this, into this riot, and were pursued and stoned. And I didn't know whether he was ever going to come back home.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they got away without too much of a problem. But that's the sort of thing that you live with, you know, that these things happen, and they can happen to anybody. And okay, not everybody would go into race riots to report on them, but, you know, in terms of your own home, the same way that I described our bodies used to come into the mortuary, you'd go home and you'd open up your sliding gates and your garage door, and you would not get out of your car until they had both been closed behind you. And so you'd never get out of your car in the street or even in the driveway, because carjackings were common, and it was a common way for people to get into your home. So you drive home, they grab your car and you, and, you know, they're into your home. So that's the sort of thing that people lived with all the time. And there are very few people who don't know somebody who was robbed or injured or, you know, or worse.
And when you got home at night, how did you decompress, or how did you be, in, for want of a better term, normal? How did you go, hey kids, how was your day?
Yeah, I have to confess, I did not do that very well at all, because at the time I actually had three young children, and when my three kids were all under four, my delightful partner decided he was moving on, so that left me with three kids.
Wow.
I sometimes look back and wonder, how did I actually survive that all? But, you know, you do what you have to do. But it was very...
How old were you when he... So you had three kids under four.
Yep.
Were you a medical examiner then, or what was your job?
No, I was going into psychiatry then. So I was probably... I would have been moving into psychiatry at that stage. I was 30... I was an old mother at the time. That I was an old mother. Nowadays, it wouldn't be seen that way. But I had my kids when I was 30, 32, and 34.
Mm.
And he left when my youngest, who's now 39, was less than 12 months.
Well, he seems so nice. Wow. And, okay, so you got three kids under four. Your husband goes. You're a doctor. You're living in a really, you know, potentially dangerous environment. How did you keep your shit together?
I probably didn't from time to time, but, you know, I come back to the you do what you have to do. If I relived my life then, I might have asked for a little bit more help, but there wasn't much available. I had parents who were living in Joburg at that time, and they did help a little bit with babysitting, but I had a somewhat distant relationship with them. So I just did what I had to do, and decided to make the move here when, on a very particular day, I used to work at night as well, which was quite scary, actually. And I remember driving to examine somebody at about 11 o'clock at night and thinking, now that I'm a single parent, I actually will have to carry a firearm to make sure that there's somebody around for those kids. And that was the deal breaker for me. Mm. That was the deal breaker. And I thought, I cannot bring up children and I cannot spend the rest of my life carrying a firearm. Mm. And so I reactivated my application to come to Australia, which I had turned down a couple of years before, the glebe job, the pathology job I had turned down. And the Australian embassy, I think quite rightly, gave me a bit of a hard time and said, look, we gave you a ticket 2 years ago. Why didn't you come? Mm. So, you know, but anyway. Mm.
Can I ask you a hard question?
Yeah, go for it.
Were you a crap mum sometimes because you were so busy?
Oh, totally. I was probably quite often a crap mum.
But I mean, that's a hard, but I mean, you're doing, I mean, it's hard to be a great mum under those circumstances. I'm not saying you weren't trying.
No. Oh, totally. I mean, I look back sometimes and I think, well, you know, there's so many things that had things been different, I would have done differently. I mean, one of the crappiest things that I did is I actually didn't watch the diet of my children very well. And I've got three kids and two of them ended up quite significantly overweight. My son, quite recently in the last couple of years, has taken that all into his own hands and he's lost tons of weight. So he's, you know, he told me that he turned 40. He said, Mum, I've turned 40 and I'm looking at you at what you can do. So, you know, I'm going to, so he changed his diet. He did more exercise. So he's changed, he lost lots of weight. But my youngest daughter, whom I've got a spectacular relationship with, she's awesome. She grew up as a very obese teenager. And girls are horrible. She had a really hard time. She was a fat teenager. She wouldn't mind me saying that, because she was. And hated going to school and wouldn't play sport. And she was miserable. And at that time, I still had the way of thinking that just pull your shit together and lose weight and things will be better. But she was so heavy at that stage that she couldn't. It was just too much for her to actually overcome. And she ended up having a gastric bypass surgery. And I still, this is more than 20 years ago now. I still look back on that and say, I had to have been a really awful mother to have let that happen. It happened on my watch, you know, under my eyes.
I don't think you're an awful mum, but I think
it. Well, that aspect of things, I think, you know.
Yeah, it's funny that you say girls are horrible. Why are girls so hard on girls? And yeah. I know it's not everyone, but it seems like a lot of women say that to me. Like a lot of women go, can I say exactly what they say? These are not my words, everyone. So don't send me an email. They go, oh, women are bitches.
Yeah.
And they say that about them. Is that true, Tiff, that women say that?
Yeah.
I'm like, I go, what do you mean? It's like, oh, because guys don't commentate on how each other look or what we're wearing or whether or not, I don't know, we don't, you know, we've got our flaws. We've got more flaws than women for sure, but that's not one of them, I don't think.
Yeah. Look, I think there's in teenage girls, there's very much a hierarchy. They get into their groups. And, you know, I send my kids to private schools and my youngest, Liesl, it was not the best thing for her. It really wasn't, because I think you see a bit, well, I might be judged for this, but I think you see a bit more of this often in private schools. So you get the cool kids.
Mm.
And then amongst the cool kids, you get the coolest kid who's sort of, you know, the dominant person in that group. And then you get other groups. And then you get the group that she describes laughingly now as the one that she belonged to, was a group of kids who didn't belong in any other group. So they had their little, you know, their little, and they were, never the twain shall meet. Mm. So I think hopefully that most of them grow out of that. It's finding your place in the pecking order in life. And I'm not saying all girls do that, but I speak to tons of parents and most parents say to me, it's easier to bring up boys than girls. And I know that's a general statement.
Tiff, you would have been problematic, wouldn't you?
I was just hanging out with the lads, mate, climbing trees.
You would have been, were you a total tomboy at school?
No, I was, Oh, maybe a little. I don't know.
Really?
I don't know.
I can't picture.
I was one of those. I was a bit of a chameleon. I would hang out with the sporty kids. I'd hang out with the naughty kids. I was a goody two shoes in primary school, and then in high school, I would hang out with everyone.
Right, sporty and naughty.
Sporty and naughty. I was like the naughty kid behind the back of the sports shed, smoking cigarettes, that got voted in as vice captain of the sports team because I was cool with all the non-sporty people that voted me in.
That's hilarious.
That was super smart, actually. Yeah.
And all right, let's circle back. We've got to wind up, but let's circle back to vicarious trauma. So, does it affect you now, Doc? You know, like stepping away from the medical examiner stuff, and then you stepped into psychiatry, where essentially you're talking to people about their problems and their issues and their challenges. And, you know, a lot of people that you're talking to are not in a great place. Has that, what impact, if any, has that had on you? It, just broadly speaking.
Yeah, look, I think over time I've obviously adapted to that better, and I've got a lot more in my life than just that. I think that's probably the really helpful thing for me, is that I've got, you know, my life isn't just going to work, which it was for many years. But yeah, I mean, you know, it can be really heartbreaking sometimes to listen to people's stories and to be able to do only so much. And,
yeah.
You know, severe psychiatric illness can be absolutely awful.
Yeah.
And people can live with things that are really difficult to manage and difficult to treat for a lifetime. And then those people have all got parents who walk the same path with them. And so they traumatize. And I've met a lot of those parents who have had severely unwell children, or children with severely unwell parents, whose whole life is affected by that, and that can be incredibly difficult. And obviously we have success stories too, where people get things sorted and we help them and they get better, and that's great. But you know, we've got a long way to go still in psychiatry in terms of managing some of the more severe stuff. And then I guess the other thing, now that I'm working in the public system in the emergency department, I see a lot of drug abuse.
Mm.
So we have a lot of aggressive behavior in emergency departments, and you know, it's often directed to me.
Mm.
I actually am not fussed with that at all. I deal with that quite well, because it's, you know, it's not personal, and you know, they mean it to be personal, but I can't tell you how often I've been called a fucking whatever in the emergency department frequently.
Mm.
And it's usually with people who are either drug affected or have a psychotic process. And I have enormous patience with people who are psychotic. They can actually say anything to me, and I don't mind. I really don't. And I've learned to my way of adapting to that. And I guess this is where I have maybe the benefit of being 100 years old, because I can kind of say almost whatever I like, you know.
Sure can.
And so when people tell me, as happens often, fuck off, I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
Then I've just developed a strategy of really keeping cool and saying, I'll fuck off when you talk to me. So just, you know.
Really?
And they look at me, oh, she's old and she's saying fuck. But it you know, it actually creates a kind of a connection with a lot of people.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, well, now, don't say that, you know.
Yes, don't use that language here. You're in public.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. All right, my last question. Now, I don't know if you want to answer this, but you were talking earlier about maybe doing something completely different. Do you want to tell us what space? You can either tell us not at all, or you can give us a vague idea, or you can be quite specific.
Yeah. No, I'm looking at keeping a number of balls juggling in the air, but not too many, because then I don't do anything properly. So one is doing something completely out of medicine, and that's probably the carpentry, but that's just a little sort of side interest. I'm probably looking to do a little bit less of the stuff that I'm doing now. I mean, there are only so many cups of coffee that can be thrown at you and that kind of stuff. And I guess my frustration is not with people who are really ill. My frustration is with people who choose to make bad choices over and over and over again and end up in our emergency department repeatedly. So probably a little bit less tolerant for that than I was a number of years ago. And maybe that's an indication that, you know, it's time to do something else. So I was looking at doing, and I haven't really formulated this properly, going into some research of some kind, looking at the intersection between psychiatric illness and other lifestyle issues, probably more related to sleep and to food, and looking at sort of the gut microbiome and how it interacts. And there's a lot of work being done on this already. So I haven't actually sorted out what tiny little aspect of this I will work with, but there's just so much, such exciting stuff going on now that I learn every day, stuff I never learned at medical school. And I suspect stuff that probably may not even be taught at medical school now, but there's just an explosion of information. And I think it's really a pity that we don't know more about this. So I'm learning every day, and I'm really fascinated with the whole gut brain connection.
The beauty now is you don't need to, you can study however you want, whenever you want. Yeah. You don't need to write papers. You don't need to submit anything. You don't need to do anything. You can just do it intuitively and instinctively and, you know, freestyle, which is, it's nice to have the freedom to learn just the stuff you're interested in, you know?
So that's where what I'm looking at going forward.
Perfect. All right. Now, are you on social media yet?
Oh, I am, but it's pretty much my own, just myself and my friends and my family.
All right. Well, we'll keep you out of that. Yeah. Well, Doc, we appreciate you as always. Thank you for thanks for sliding into the U Project yet again. I will talk to you soon personally, I'm sure, but thanks for hanging out with us.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Tiff.
Thanks, Ingrid. Nice to meet you finally.
Good to meet you too.
Stay there, Doc. Thanks, everyone. Love you, guts. See you next time.